My name is Nehemiah, and this is my story. I will tell how I, a simple cupbearer, became an influential leader and restored the city of Jerusalem. It is essential to understand that I am a man far from my homeland. For years, my people were captured and exiled from Israel. For a long time, we sinned against God and did not repent, even when he rebuked us. Our exile, led by King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, was not surprising. He invaded Israel 3 times, taking our people captive. The prophet Jeremiah had already prophesied that our captivity would last 70 years, Jeremiah 29:10. The years passed, and Nebuchadnezzar died. Now, under the rule of King Artaxerxes of Persia, I remained captive, serving as the king's cupbearer in Susa, the Persian capital. Though my body was in Persia, my heart and thoughts remained in Jerusalem, more than 800 miles away. I was interested in hearing news of those who had returned to Jerusalem. Despite being in a position where I should be concerned with other matters, my heart belonged to God and therefore to others. I carried the burden for the remnant of Judah, even without sharing in their suffering. One day, one of my brothers arrived from Judah with other men. I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile in Jerusalem. They reported that those who returned faced great difficulty and shame. The wall of Jerusalem was in ruins, and its gates were burned. The news was disheartening. The precarious condition of the city reflected the state of its people. Without walls, Jerusalem was open to enemies, defenseless and vulnerable. Everything of value could be easily stolen, leaving its inhabitants in constant fear. Faced with this reality, my heart filled with a divine urgency. I knew it was time to act. Just as God had restored his people in the past, I felt the call to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, not just as a physical fortification, but as a symbol of divine restoration and protection. Nehemiah 2:17-18. It was imperative for me to ensure the safety and well-being of my people. I knew that every man cares for his loved ones, and I was determined to do whatever it took to bring hope and restoration to Jerusalem. Even with the temple rebuilt, its beauty was fleeting, as anything valuable was quickly plundered. Upon hearing this news, my legs lost strength, and I sat down, overcome with tears. For days, I wept, fasting and praying to the God of heaven. I cried out, "Lord, God of heaven, great and awesome, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name.'" Nehemiah 1:8-9. "They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. I did not complain or seek someone to solve the problem. I immediately did what I knew was possible, pray and intensely seek God in this situation. I knew exactly to whom I was fasting and praying. There are many gods that people believe in, but only the God of heaven can meet my needs. I prayed to God about my pain and anguish, surrendering them to him. As the king's cupbearer, it was my duty to serve him wine and taste it. The king's cupbearer is not just a servant, but a special guardian. By tasting the wine and food before the king, I ensured he was not poisoned. The cupbearer had to be a man of faithful and impressive character, in whom the king placed immense trust. If the cupbearer were corrupt, it would be easy to assassinate the king. Naturally, the cupbearer was often consulted on various matters that came to the king. After praying and waiting for 4 months, I finally received an answer. The day arrived when everything would change for me and my people. My face showed the sadness I felt for Jerusalem, something the king had never seen in me. He asked, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." In the king's court, it was forbidden to be sad, as it was believed that the presence of the king should be enough to dispel any sadness. Being in the presence of such a great king should theoretically dispel all sadness. When the king noticed my sadness, I felt he took it seriously. Knowing that the next royal command could be fatal, I confessed the truth. "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king's response was a surprise. Instead of anger, he asked, "What is it you want?" I was petrified, but I knew this was a significant opportunity. Much depended on my response. It could change everything. I understood that it was not my place to change the king's heart, so I prayed quickly and left it in the Lord's hands. I explained my sadness and the situation of Jerusalem, a city destroyed and dishonored. The king's response was not anger, but a willingness to help. My four-month prayer was answered. I asked for permission to go to Judah and rebuild the city. The king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked how long the journey would take and when I would return. I presented a detailed plan, the result of 4 months of prayer and reflection. I asked the king for letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates to ensure my safe passage, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the royal park, requesting timber for the gates of the citadel, for the city wall, and for the residence I would occupy. I knew exactly what I needed: letters for safe passage and materials for reconstruction. My preparation during the 4 months of prayer was sufficient. The king granted all my requests. The gracious hand of my God was clearly upon me. Everything was ready. I traveled to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, delivering the king's letters. He also sent army officers and cavalry with me. Additionally, I received a significant amount of timber from the royal forest. Despite the generosity of the king of Persia, this was only the beginning of great difficulties. Upon arriving at the governor's post, I encountered enemies of Jerusalem who could ruin everything. Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah the Ammonite were deeply disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. While Jerusalem remained weak and vulnerable, they did not care, even with the temple there and worship being conducted. For them, it was all right, as long as the people of God were not strong, secure, and free from stress. But this opposition did not deter me. I went to Jerusalem with a great dream, much hope, much prayer, and much support from the king. My arrival in Jerusalem, accompanied by a military escort and timber from the forest of the king of Persia, certainly drew attention, but I kept my mission secret until the right time. After 3 days in the city, I went out at night with a few men to inspect the broken walls of Jerusalem and its burned gates. It was necessary to see the extent of the damage before starting the reconstruction. Although there had been progress in Jerusalem, the temple was rebuilt, sacrifices and worship were happening, it was crucial to also look at what was wrong. The city's authorities and people still did not know my plans, as I had not yet shared them. The people of Jerusalem, including its leaders, seemed to have accepted that rebuilding the walls was impossible. When someone tried in the past, enemies quickly interrupted the efforts, so I presented the situation to them. "You see the trouble we are in? Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace." The meeting with the city's leaders was crucial. It was impossible to complete the task alone. I explained about the gracious hand of God on me and what the king had said. To the leaders, I assured that this was not my project, but a project of God. They responded, "Let us start rebuilding." And so, the good work began. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem heard about it, they mocked us, asking, "What are you doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Tobiah was a powerful figure due to his connections with the high priest's family and his ability to get help from the priests. His name means "Yahweh is good." Ironic for someone who opposed the work of God. Through their marriages, Sambalat was connected to the priestly families. It was expected that these men, my brothers and citizens of Jerusalem, would support my work. But unfortunately, that did not happen. Opposition is always difficult, but when it comes from one's own brothers, it feels like betrayal. Sambalat and Tobiah used ridicule as a weapon. They wanted me to feel mocked, stupid, and foolish. With scorn, they asked if I intended to rebel against the king. This question revealed how little they understood about the power of God. First, they were ignorant of the king of Persia's support for my project. Secondly, they did not comprehend the magnitude of God's power. Even if the king of Persia opposed the work, it would not matter because the God of heaven and earth was in favor of it. Faced with these accusations, I declared, "The God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding, but you have no share, no right, no historic claim in Jerusalem." The reconstruction began with fervor. The high priest and his fellow priests rebuilt the sheep gate. The gates, being critical points of entry and exit from the city and likely targets of enemy attacks, were of utmost importance. The work expanded from each gate. Each gate was consecrated, symbolizing that it was special and dedicated to God's glory and care. The priests understood that God wanted everything to be consecrated exclusively to him, including the city's walls and gates. The reconstruction was a communal effort. Each person or family had an individual responsibility. While most joined the work, some, like the nobles of Tekoa, refused to participate, not wanting to submit or bend their necks to the work that the Lord required. The Jeshanah Gate was repaired by men from different professions, not professional builders. They had no specific skills for this work, but still they dedicated themselves to the task, showing a common commitment to rebuilding Jerusalem. The determination of the people was evident. They built the walls around Jerusalem, set its beams, doors, bolts, and bars. Each man was responsible for a specific section of the wall, and it was important that no one thought poorly of their work for God. I encouraged everyone, from the humblest to the highest, to work together. From the man who lived in a single room to the leaders and the high priest, everyone united efforts. I encourage people to start with their own homes and did not reject anyone for their past mistakes. When Sambalat heard that we were repairing the wall, he was offended and furious. He mocked us before his companions and the army of Samaria, questioning our ability to restore the wall, finish the work in a day, or revive the stones from the ruins. Tobiah the Ammonite, beside him, added with scorn that even a fox could knock down the wall we were building. The enemy's words contained a grain of truth. We would not complete the work in a day, and our tools were not the best. But instead of confronting them directly, I took my concerns to God in prayer, asking him to hear our cause and turn their insults back on them. "Hear us, O God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads," I prayed. "Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Do not cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they have thrown insults in the face of the builders." Despite the opposition, we rebuilt the wall to half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. However, the Arabs, Ammonites, and people of Ashdod were furious when they heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble. This threat was serious. The wall, built to protect against violent attacks, now seemed to attract violence. There could be fear and concern that all the hard work would be in vain. The enemies aimed to create confusion among the people of God, for a confused people do not advance. Confusion often results from distractions caused by the enemy's tricks, diverting the attention of God's people away from his promises. However, we continued to pray to God, and because of the threat, we set up a guard day and night. Nothing would make us stop praying. We could have given up, thinking that God was not answering our prayers as the attacks continued. But our faith was stronger. I was determined not to let either daylight or the sleep of night keep me from working. This sent a powerful message. I told the people of God, "We are committed. This will work because God is with us and will help us overcome every problem." To the enemies, It showed that they would not be victorious in their endeavors. The work begun by God cannot be stopped. It did not matter the sleepless nights or the tiring days. We were willing to do whatever it took to complete the work. We sent a message to God. We trust in you, and our faith is a living faith, a faith of actions, not just words. However, the difficulties did not cease. Besides the external challenges, there were internal problems. Judah, known for its strength and bravery, expressed that the strength of the laborers was failing because there was so much rubble, making it difficult to rebuild the wall. The discouragement from the tribe of Judah was quite an obstacle. The halfway point is always dangerous. Much has been done, but there is still much to be done. Fatigue begins to set in. Rebuilding the walls was not just a matter of construction, but also of cleaning and removing rubble accumulated for 100 years. Removing this rubble was essential to rebuilding the walls on their foundations. And our adversaries said, "They will not know or see anything until we come among them and kill them and put an end to the work." We were already in a difficult situation, and the discouraged workers felt like giving up. Now the enemies were planning an attack. The workers, aware of the dangerous plan of the enemies, were not intimidated. God was in control, despite all the adversaries' efforts. The loyal ones listened and reported the enemy's plans, but many were frightened, troubled by my lack of fear. I positioned people behind the lowest points of the wall at the exposed places, posting them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After examining the situation, I spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons and daughters, your wives and your homes." I ordered them to equip themselves with armor, preparing to fight with all available resources. The magnitude of the task was great, but there was no reason for fear. When our enemies heard that we were aware of their plot and that God had frustrated it, we all returned to the wall, each to our work. Seeing our defenses, the adversaries retreated, not wanting a battle they knew they would lose. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers supported all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. I communicated to everyone. "The work is extensive, and we are widely separated along the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, join us there. Our God will fight for us." I instructed everyone to stay in Jerusalem at night, to serve as guards by night and workmen by day. Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each kept their weapon, even when going for water. However, economic difficulties arose. Some complained about the need for grain to feed their large families. Others were mortgaging their fields, vineyards, and homes to buy grain during the famine and to pay the king's tax. My work was not about money, but financial problems directly affected the reconstruction work. The people faced financial problems because they dedicated themselves to building the walls, thus neglecting the provision for their families. A famine exacerbated the situation, raising the price of food, forcing some to mortgage their properties to buy food. The continuous government taxes increased the pressure, even with the reduced work and the rising cost of living. Although we did not consider these taxes unjust, they represented a great burden. Debts accumulated, and some failed in their payments, being forced to give their children as servants to the creditors. The wealthy exploited the crisis, charging interest of 12% per year. If I and my people did not find a way to deal with our financial problems according to God's will, God's work would have stopped without a single attack from the enemies being necessary. So, I called a great assembly to deal with the matter. I told the nobles that we had bought back our Jewish brothers sold to the Gentiles, but now they were selling their own people, who ended up being bought back by us. They had no answer to this. I began lending money and grain to the locals without interest, and instructed the nobles to do the same. They agreed to return the properties and cancel the interest. I called the priests and made the nobles and officials swear to keep this promise. I shook out the folds of my robe, saying that in the same way, God would remove from their house and possessions anyone who broke this promise. Soon after, I was appointed governor of Judah. Unlike previous governors who burdened the people with heavy taxes, I did not take advantage of the position. Out of reverence for God, I did not act oppressively. I devoted myself to the work on the wall, not acquiring land. Additionally, 150 Jews and officials dined at my table daily, supported by my generosity. Despite the abundant supply of wine every 10 days, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, conscious of the great burden already imposed on the people. When Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and our other enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall without gaps, though the doors were not yet set in the gates, they tried to lure me into a trap. Sanballat and Geshem invited me to meet them in one of the villages on the plain of Ono, but I realized they intended to harm me. I sent messengers to them, saying that I was doing a great work and could not come down. They repeated the invitation four times, and I declined in the same way. On the fifth attempt, Sanballat sent his servant with an open letter, alleging that I and the people planned to rebel and that I would become their king. I replied that such allegations were inventions of their own minds. Despite their attempts to intimidate us and weaken our work, I prayed, "Now strengthen my hands, O God." I did not waste time defending myself point by point. I knew I would not convince men like Sanballat with facts or explanations. I understood that the strategy of slander was an attempt to instigate fear, and I refused to succumb to it. No enemy can make us fear. They only try to make us choose fear. The attacks, however, did not cease. One day, I went to the house of Shemaiah, who was shut in at home. He suggested that we take refuge together in the temple to escape an alleged assassination attempt on my life. However, I refused, questioning, "Should a man like me run away? Should I go into the temple to save my life?" I understood that Shemaiah was trying to instill fear in me and induce me to disobey God. The temple was off limits to everyone except the priests, and I was not a priest. If I followed Shemaiah's advice, I would be violating the law and dishonoring my position. I stood firm, refusing to give in to fear or disobey God's laws, regardless of the intimidation attempts of my enemies. I realized that God had not sent Shemaiah. He had been hired by the enemies to intimidate me, making me sin and thus discredit me. Shemaiah tried to make me commit a sin and thereby give my adversaries a reason to defame my name. When the news of the wall's completion spread, the surrounding nations were terrified and lost their confidence, seeing that the work had been accomplished with the help of our God. The speed with which the wall was rebuilt, in just 52 days, after more than a century in ruins, was remarkable. For over 100 years, the need to rebuild the walls was evident, but no one had mobilized. The reconstruction was not just out of necessity or desire, but a determined action under God's guidance. With the wall's completion, our enemies were disheartened, especially because it was clear that God had accomplished the work. The strength and security of the people of Jerusalem now served as a testimony to the surrounding nations. Even with the wall's completion, political intrigues continued. The nobles of Judah, connected to Tobiah by family ties, sent and received letters from him, trying to intimidate me. After rebuilding the wall and setting the doors in place, I appointed the gatekeepers, musicians, and Levites. The Levites and singers led the people in worship. The walls of Jerusalem were rebuilt not just for security, but to allow the people to worship God with even more freedom and glory. I put my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, a man who feared God more than most, in charge of Jerusalem. I instructed them to open the gates only when the sun was hot, and to shut and bar the doors while the guards were still on duty. I also appointed residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and others near their homes. Although a great victory had been achieved with the wall's reconstruction, they would not protect themselves. Continuous vigilance was necessary. Security was paramount, so we opened the city gates early. Jerusalem was large and spacious, but few people lived there, and many houses still needed to be rebuilt. God guided me to assemble the nobles, officials, and the people to register their genealogies. I wanted Jerusalem to flourish and prosper. It was essential to know who was already in the city. Just as I inspected the damaged walls, I was determined to revitalize the community. Then a great revival happened. All the people gathered as one in the square before the Watergate and asked Ezra the scribe to bring out the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded for Israel. Ezra, responsible for the temple's reconstruction and the return of worship to God, read the law before the assembly of men, women, and all who could understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon, and the people listened attentively to the book of the law. The law of Moses, comprising Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, was Israel's instruction manual for living before God. I, Nehemiah, along with Ezra and the Levites, told the people that this day was holy to the Lord, and that they should not mourn or weep, though they were weeping as they heard the words of the law. My commitment extended beyond the physical reconstruction of Jerusalem, encompassing the religious reform of Judah. I saw the need, devised a plan, and involved others in my cause. Even living far from my homeland and spending most of my life in exile, I never stopped believing in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As a prayer warrior, I took everything to God and prayed for my people. I was recognized for my hard work and persistence. My concern for my people never ceased, hoping not only for their return to our country, but also to the God who called Abraham and made a covenant with him. My name is Nehemiah, and this is my story.